ready.
Okay, so we're continuing on camera roll 13. Hold this on, is the interview with Jerry Cohen.
She's been doing the interview with Jerry Cohen for the Atlanta Grape Strike and Boycott film. Let's sort of set the stage before we talk about some specific stuff. Let's start in 1967 in People's Bar.
Yes.
Playing pool with Caesar.
Yes.
You've been watching this phenomenon from the outside, and then
yes,
you decided to cross over the line. Talk about
yes. Well, I was in law school in Berkeley, and I was aware that they were marching, and I thought it was interesting. So I was interested in California Rural Legal Assistance, and they sent this woman named Carol Rose Silver to talk to me and said that, you know, they were doing a lot of work for the union. So I went to work for CRLA, but when I got there, their office was in McFarland because they couldn't have an office in Delano, and there was a federal regulation that they couldn't represent the union. And so a couple of us started raising a little hell inside CRLA because we thought, we're not here to do federally funded divorces. We're here because we want to help the union. So I bump into Caesar in People's Bar, and I start complaining about CRLA. And basically his response was, well, you can't work for the federal government and help us because they just won't let you. Why don't you come to work with us? And my response was, well, you know, I've been out of law school just a little while and just passed the bar and I don't know a damn thing. And Caesar lied to me and he said, well, you know, we don't know anything either, so we'll just sort of learn it together. And so I had a glorious three-month career at CRLA and then I went to work for the union.
And what did you think, observing the union from the outside? What did you think they were nuts or did you think they really had something?
Well, I thought that it was a really interesting fight, and I didn't go to law school to make money. I was kind of surprised most people did. I thought law was about justice. I was pretty naive. And the alternative to that was going to work for Kanoi and Kunstler in New Jersey, but you had to live in New Jersey and fly south. That was called the Center for Constitutional Rights. And I sort of wanted to be where the action was. And I knew something was going on because you saw the march, and they had just gotten a contract with DiGiorgio, and they were in a fight with Pirelli Minetti. And the other thing that had happened, I forgot to tell you, is there was on a Saturday, there was a picket line at a Mayfair store in Bakersfield. And I noticed that these old Bircher ladies were right by the store, and Jim Drake and the farm workers are on the other side of the parking lot. So I just sort of went in there and raised a little hell and talked to this guy, Drake. I didn't know him at the time. I said, well, we should all just be milling around in front of the door. And so we made a big mess in front of the door. And then I got called in the next Monday, and I was told that I should stay away from union picket lines. And I said, well, you know, that's my time on the weekend. I'll do what I want. And so there was a little bit of tension in CRLA over that. So that had also happened. I don't know if it was just before or after I talked to Caesar in the bar. So
were you impressed with him personally? Was that
he was very quiet.
What made you decide?
No, I was interested in the idea that there was a fight going on. He was very quiet, but he was very clear about the fact that if you want to work with the union, or help the union, you got to be with the union because the feds are going to put too many restrictions on you, and you can't really do much from a legal aid society. And he was right. He was absolutely right.
But once you start working for the union, it must feel like David versus Goliath on some level in terms of your resources and the forces arrayed.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. Caesar had a bedroom. We were in this little pink house in Delano. Caesar had the bedroom, and Dolores had a bedroom where she ran negotiations. And they gave me the kitchen as the legal department. We didn't have any books. We didn't have bookcases. So we had to sort of round up the books and the bookcases. But, you know, it was – I think we had the notion, what the hell, we didn't have anything to lose, so you might as well try. And I remember one of the first interactions I had with Caesar was very interesting because he drove me to San Francisco where Vic Van Borg, this famous labor lawyer, had all the files. And one of the things that struck me when I got the files back is that they were stipulating to injunctions under the National Labor Relations Act. But farm workers weren't covered by the National Labor Relations Act. So I thought, what in the hell is going on here? How can you not have the protections of the Act, and yet the Act is telling you that you can't secondary boycott? These injunctions were stopping the union from boycotting at Mayfair. The fight was with this wine grower, Pirelli Minetti. And I looked in the law, and the way the law worked is the rights flow to, quote, employees. Employees excluded domestics, who were mostly black, of course, and farm workers. You know, a lot of Mexicans, a lot of Filipinos, a lot of poor black people. So it was no, you know, surprised that that happened. You know, in South Africa, they specifically said blacks don't have rights. We were a little more clever here. But anyhow, farm workers didn't have any rights. But a labor organization was inhibited, and a labor organization was defined as any organization that included any employee. And when we looked at the DiGiorgio contract, there were 9 guys in a peanut shed that were commercial workers. And because this union of then a few thousand people had 9 people in it, they were inhibited. So what we did is we set up this union called the United Peanut Shelling Workers of America, and we took the 9 guys and put them into the United Peanut Shelling Workers of America, and DeShetler was the president of that. And since we worked that through, that sort of developed a relationship, a trust between Caesar and me, because he thought, here's some guy that's looked at it. You know, I didn't know anything about labor law. Van Borg should have known that. He shouldn't have been stipulating to these injunctions. But rather than get rid of the 9 guys and putting them in a separate union and freeing the union, you know, the union was being, they were stipulating that they couldn't secondary boycott. So that was the first thing we worked on together. And what impressed me is, you know, he's willing to let me try anything. And
What was the mood like in 67 and going into early 68 when you started? Were people optimistic, or were they frustrated?
Well, there was a debate going on about whether to go after the wine or go after Jamara. And Jamara, then I think they had like maybe 12,000 acres of table grapes. They were then the biggest grape grower. And when we decided to take on Jamara, I think there was a lot of really good feeling that we could beat this guy, because the first few days of the strike were successful. But like most strikes in agriculture, you know, quickly they can find poor people that need to do the work. So a lot of scabs came in and broke the strike. So then the boycott started. Now, the boycott took time to develop. And I think over the late fall of 67 and certainly into the early winter of 68, some frustrations developed. And that's when some folks decided to take matters into their own hands and, you know, engage in petty acts of, you know, property damage. And, you know, Caesar at that point was making his argument that that was not only morally wrong, but it was stupid. And those are the frustrations that led up to the fast. But, you know, that came in early 68.
And you heard Caesar having these discussions with people.
I was in the Pink House when Caesar would talk to people, and the argument was, look, you know, if you have a cap gun and they have, you know, basically nuclear weapons, it's very stupid to think that you can use violence and win. Furthermore, it's wrong. And politically, it's also stupid, because to win, we have to, if we're going to have a boycott, appeal to people's goodness, you know, their what they want to do. And that meant more than just a labor movement. That meant religious people. And, you know, when you think about it, Caesar was a political genius. I mean, he was able to take the George Meany pro-Vietnam labor movement and combine it with a lot of liberal people, a lot of good religious folks that were willing to help do the boycott. But his argument was, this is going to take time to build these coalitions. You know, he tried to give people, one thing that was really good about him is he gave people a sense of confidence. You go and experiment, I don't care if you win or lose, as long as you're trying, you're going to have my support. So, you know, you send somebody like Marcos Munoz to Boston or Eliseo to Chicago, none of us knew what the hell a boycott was like. And remember, the boycott started as only a boycott against Jamara, the Ara label. But Jamara and all their buddies decided they would trade all their labels. So all these labels ended up in the Jamara fields. And at that point, we basically said, well, what the hell? We'll just boycott the whole industry and see what happens. That doesn't happen overnight. It created the kind of frustrations. Not everybody was angels. They wouldn't listen to Caesar's argument. And that's when he said, well, basically, we'll see, you know, who's right or wrong here. And he went out and he started fasting, I think about the middle of, maybe the middle of February, he started to fast. And that's also very interesting, the fast. When he started the fast, he was basically saying, whoever is engaged in any talks with anybody, stop. This is not a fast to put pressure on agribusiness. This is a fast for us to examine ourselves. This is going to be a time of reflection, and we're going to talk about what nonviolence means. And that fast generated a lot of power. I sort of view the fast as the kind of glue that really knit the union together. You know, what we had at that time was maybe 7 or 8 contracts, or maybe 9 with wine growers. But since this was all new to people, the committees were very busy working on their own contracts, understandably so. That fast provided an event over which everybody came together. And the specific event that caused that is that Jamara was stupid enough to bring him to court for contempt of an injunction on the 13th day of his fast. And that's when we went to the courthouse. And, you know, before that time, that courthouse, I used to get nervous as hell going in that courthouse. It felt like enemy territory. But after that fast, it was like we sort of claimed that territory. We had 3,000 workers, you know, engaged in a nonviolent demonstration. And even, you know, the county employees and everybody else were impressed with the way, you know, that demonstration took place. And I remember Jamara's attorney was named Bill Quinlan, and he went into the presiding judge, a guy named Osborne, and said, you know, we got to kick these farm workers out of here because they're putting undue pressure on the judicial system. And Osborne said to him, Bill, if I kick these workers out of this courthouse, it'll be another example of goddamn gringo justice. I had never heard a judge talk like that before. You know, I had all the constitutional arguments as to why workers had a right to be peacefully demonstrating there, but those arguments wouldn't have won the day without the presence of the workers. So there was a real power in that fast.
So how does an Irish Jewish guy feel when he sees 3,000 farm workers kneeling and praying? The movement was very religious.
Yes. Well, and also every night you would participate in a mass at the end of the day, and, you know, you could give a little cross. Well, you know, my mother was Irish Catholic. My father was a Lithuanian Jew. I didn't grow up in either religion. I grew up, you know, basically as a baseball fan on the weekends. I had no problem with it because I saw the power of it. Some people were arguing that Caesar was cynically manipulating religion, but this wasn't any cynical manipulation. The guy wasn't eating. He was directly appealing to people's better instincts. And, you know, there are a lot of values in all these religions that are worth something, or they wouldn't have hung around for 2,000 years. I had no problem with it at all. I felt totally comfortable. There were some people that left over the fast, though, because they felt, what is this guy trying to do? Is he making himself a god? But the fast was about something real. And what I think people forget, when you look back at Caesar through the lens of history, you say, here was a guy that had total control over an institution. At that point, it was nonsense. There was a real argument going on because there were a lot of macho guys running around saying, you know, we gotta teach these growers a lesson, and violence is the way to do it. There was a real debate for the soul of that movement at that point, and I saw the fast as a way of taking dead aim on those people who saw violence as a solution. And Caesar was saying, as I said, it's immoral, it's stupid, it's a shortcut, and it won't build the movement. So I had no problem with it. I was a big fan of the fast, as you can tell.
Do you think Caesar had been preparing for this, or was it just an impulse that made him respond that way, or had he been getting ready as a way of disciplining himself so that he could fast?
Well, I know he'd been preparing himself because I was involved in the Pirelli-Minetti negotiations. And before those he wanted me involved in those negotiations along with Dolores. And I had gone up to do an arbitration, I think, in Marysville. And when I came back, Dolores told me, we got to get this thing going pretty fast because Caesar hasn't eaten in 10 days. And I didn't know that. Now, he wasn't fasting to put any pressure on Pirelli Minetti because Pirelli Minetti didn't know he was fasting. But I think he was conducting an experiment on himself to see if he could fast. And he wasn't going to personally end that fast until we got some progress with Pirelli Minetti. So that put... I felt some pressure about that. That put some pressure on us. So he had experimented a couple times, and I knew about that one personally because of those Pirelli Minetti negotiations.
But I mean, obviously, since that fast wasn't public knowledge, what he was really doing was testing himself. Right?
Yes, he was testing himself. Remember, he was pretty conversant with Gandhi. He looked at what Gandhi did. And he was impressed with the various nonviolent tools Gandhi used. He was following what was going on in the South. He was impressed with what King had done. Yes, he was testing himself. That's right.
Why do you think he decided to end the fast? Did he feel that he had made his point, or was he about to die, or what was the dynamic?
Well, there were some health concerns, but Caesar wasn't terribly motivated by the health concerns. I think he was seeing visible progress. For example, there was one meeting in which Tony Orendine, who was not a big fan of the fast, was in the bedroom. I'll never forget. Caesar's on his bed. It's like the 18th, 19th day of the fast. Orendine wouldn't even look at him. He turned around and looked away from him. And it was like he was really offended by Caesar's fasting. But I could see that inside, the dynamic inside the union was beginning to change. First, what you saw was all these ranch committees coming together. What were they doing? They were engaging in nonviolent demonstration at the courthouse, which generated real pressure on the justice system of Kern County. Caesar could see the progress. And I think at some point he thought he had made his point to the people that counted. And the people that disagreed, there was an exodus of a few people after the fast. So basically he drew a line, and he said, this is the way we're going to do it. And he made his point, and then he moved on. And I'm not, in my mind, it wasn't the doctor's advice that ended that fast. And also, just as a practical matter, Bobby Kennedy had decided that he'd come out and share the last day of the fast. And, you know, Caesar's a complicated guy. He's also a pretty shrewd politician. And part of the point of the fast was not only to educate people in the movement about nonviolence, but it was to make an impact. Because remember, we're on a boycott. And we want to make the biggest impact we can. And I think when Caesar realized that Bobby was going to come, what better way to end the fast than you know, break bread with Bobby Kennedy? And that's exactly what happened, I think, maybe around the 10th of March. So I think he went 25 days.
And Kennedy's coming on the last day of the fast, and you're one of the people that arrives with Kennedy.
Yes.
Talk about that.
Well, we went to... we went, Jim Drake and I think Andy Amouton and I, I think it was Andy, we went to pick up Bobby Kennedy and Peter Edelman in Bakersfield, and we came back to the 40 acres. And the thing that impressed me about Kennedy and Edelman was that they were really interested in what we needed. Most politicians in Washington at that time were lecturing us saying you need the National Labor Relations Act to cover farm workers. And even though I hadn't studied labor law, I knew enough just from my few months in the union to know that that wasn't workable because it takes too much time to have an election. They have stuff called craft units in the National Labor Relations Act, which if you imposed them on the fields would be like legislatively mandated ghettos in the fields. The poor minorities would be on the worst jobs. You know, white guys would get the machines. So when Kennedy asked us what we wanted, you know, did we want to be covered by the NLRA, we said no. What we want is something that might not be politically that easy for you to do. We want enforcement of the green card regulation. What was that? If there was a certified strike, a green card could not work behind the picket line. All right? So, you know, here's a guy thinking about running for president. There are obviously some cross currents there, but he said he'd help us, and he did. He helped us get the Labor Department to enforce those regulations. We had some hearings where we got certifications of the strike, and we wanted the INS to enforce the notion that these guys couldn't work as scabs behind our picket line. So Bobby was receptive to what we needed, even though it might not be politically that advantageous for him. And he and Edelman followed up on that.
Was when you picked him up, was he very confident in himself, or did he... Was he uncertain about how to deal with...
Well, what he said was, what do you say to a guy on a fast?
Start over again.
Bobby Kennedy told us in the car, well, Bobby Kennedy wondered, what does one say to a guy on a fast? This was after we had this discussion about the NLRA is really not high on our agenda, this immigration stuff is. And, you know, I think he was very interested in Caesar because, remember, he had been to Delano before and he had to lecture the sheriff of Kern County, and he advised maybe the sheriff maybe he ought to read the Constitution. So he was aware of the fight. He admired Caesar, but I think he was a little bit uneasy. You know, one of the interesting things, I don't know, this shouldn't...
Okay, I turned my cell phone off. Can't be Jerry's cell phone.
Yeah, I don't have one. I'm a Luddite.
Rick, just, I think we have to do is cut to the chase on the what do you say... Bobby, because what's happened with these, we're not going to be able to include a lot of the details.
Yeah.
So we can kind of go into what do you say?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Kind of, you know,
yeah.
Yeah.